Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another Immigrantly episode with me, Sadia Khan. Now, my longtime listeners know that this platform is dedicated to highlighting the voices of immigrants and communities of color. If you're new, welcome, and thank you for joining me on this journey. Most of the time, I am interviewing a guest on their identity, their personal journeys, their careers, and their take on this complicated thing we all call life. But sometimes I like to deep dive into a concept on my own and explore the topics that have recently been on my mind. Today is one of those episodes.
The Israel-Hamas war stoking protests across the U.S. at various college campuses.
The rush to find a safe corner inside embattled Gaza is becoming more perilous by the hour as the Israeli military dramatically expands its combat footprint.
Do you have a written document by the government with a clear intent to commit genocide?
Local officials said the airstrikes used in the raid killed more than 60 Palestinians, including women and children.
Do you think that in Rwanda, Bosnia-Herzegovina, any government officials wrote, "I want to commit genocide"?
Rafah is a crowded city sheltering more than 1 million displaced people.
It doesn't work like that.
Now, most of you have probably heard or seen something regarding Israel and Palestine for many months now. In fact, we at Immigrantly did an episode a while back discussing some of the problematic language I have seen in the news about this issue, the dog whistling, the not so subtle bias, and the way that connects to other historical events. You know what I'm talking about, right? That episode is called The Quiet Violence of Language. If you want to check it out, it's available on all different streaming platforms. But I've been wanting to discuss another trend I've been seeing in the media, especially in the news. It's now pretty common to hear the word genocide applied to what's happening in Palestine. You would think that such a big, awful term would alert people to the very real and very, very terrifying death tolls in Gaza. And yet, as I've been learning recently, there's been a lot of debate over this word, its definition, and whether or not Israel is committing genocide. The sources and experts we once trusted now disagree with one another on a very crucial subject. And that, to me, is alarming. So today, I wanted to share thoughts on why there is such a discrepancy when it comes to the definition of genocide. This is especially important because as someone who has studied genocide, I find it difficult to fathom why there is so much debate, so much back and forth about the concept and how it applies to Palestine. So in this episode, I will address, through a discussion of nuances, some pertinent questions such as, what makes genocide so difficult to define and recognize? In fact, what is the actual definition of genocide? What does genocide actually look like? What are the long-term consequences? And how do we reach justice and reconciliation after genocidal events? Look, I know it won't be an easy episode, but I am hoping that by tackling this term, we can better understand what's happening right now and also in the future. Throughout this episode, we'll also have some insights from a very special guest, Professor Ernesto Verdeja.
My name is Ernesto Verdeja. I'm an associate professor of peace studies and global politics at the University of Notre Dame.
He has written and spoken about genocide in general many times, but he has also spoken on Palestine specifically and how the genocide question applies there. In this space, I'm going to share his thoughts and expertise with all of you to help us consider the questions I am exploring today. all the sources, by the way, we are using for this episode will be linked in the show notes. So let's dive in. Listeners, you may be surprised to know that the word genocide is relatively recent. Its origin takes us back to the 1940s, to a man named Raphael Lemkin, a Jewish lawyer from Poland.
Genocide is a new word combining the Greek word genos, genos meaning race or group, with the root of the Latin sidere meaning to kill. Dr. Raphael Lemkin, who is a professor of law at Yale University and specializing in teaching matters about the United Nations. Dr. Lemkin is the man who created the word genocide. Dr. Lemkin, could you give us a little background on how you came to be interested in this genocide?
I became interested in genocide because it happened so many times. It happened to the Armenians, and after the Armenians, Hitler took action.
The 1940s has just witnessed the horrors of the Holocaust, Nazi Germany's systemic murder of European Jewish populations. World powers agreed that these actions were horrible. However, at the time, there was no technical term for killing mass amounts of a specific ethnic group. This is where Raphael Lemkin comes in. Lemkin's goal was to hold the mass murder of a race or ethnic group to international standards. He believed that such brutal actions go beyond the words murder or atrocity, and that we needed a new word to identify the targeted massacre of ethnic, religious, national, or racial groups. And by 1948, the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide solidified a definition, which I want to quote here, so listeners, pay close attention. Genocide includes the following: killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. That's the definition. So technically, genocide isn't limited to murder. Limiting resources to destroy a group is genocide. So is preventing reproduction or transferring children away from their born ethnic group or nation. There's also no minimum or maximum number of victims. Recognized genocides can range from, say, a couple of thousand people to many millions of people. Now you may be thinking, wars also cause many thousands or many millions of deaths, right? Well, yes and no. The difference lies in genocide's racial, religious, national, or ethnic targeting. Genocide targets individuals simply because they are members of an ethnic, religious, national, or racial group, not because of their actions or behaviors. In other words, mass killing should have nothing to do with the victim's behavior in order for it to be considered a genocide. At least in theory, genocide is the crime of being, as one article puts it, being punished for an unchangeable aspect of your identity. This is an important point. And I want you guys to think about it and sit with it for a minute. And for this reason, perhaps, people see genocide as the crime of all crimes, the worst possible thing one could do. So with a formal definition, now I want to return to this question of why there is so much disagreement over whether or not we should be using this term right now.
Are we looking at a genocide?
The notion that Israel's committing ethnic cleansing and genocide is absurd.
What language should commentators and journalists be using now?
What's happening in Palestine is a genocide.
The genocide in Gaza is not just about Palestinian liberation.
There is a genocide happening right now.
Israel has completely destroyed the civilian infrastructure in Gaza. It has targeted churches, mosques, schools, hospitals, and universities. This is what genocide in real time is like.
Are we now looking at a genocide? Or has there always been a genocide taking place?
So the question as to whether genocide is occurring in Israel's war against Gaza is a vexing question, particularly because a lot of it pivots on what exactly is meant by genocide.
To get some clarity on this, we spoke to Professor Ernesto Verdeja, who provided some perspective as to why the term is more difficult than it may seem.
Genocide is one of these terms that it has a legal definition, quite a specific one, but it's also used in a number of other different ways. And we need to consider that before we get into a debate over whether it's genocide or not. We need to appreciate the fact that there are multiple and contending understandings of what's at play, which explains why there could be so much discrepancy.
From here, Verdeja identifies about four connotations of the word. There's the legal definition from 1948, as I outlined earlier. But sometimes we use the word genocide because it conjures extensive suffering. Even those who don't know the specific definitions may use the term as the nearest descriptor for extreme harm. Policymakers have also their connotation for the term genocide, which hinges on protecting basic human rights. Professor Verdeja explains.
This is basically because policymakers involved in prevention work, prevention of mass atrocities and genocide, are more interested in preventing severe human rights violations. And genocide is just one part of that.
Lastly, scholars like Verdeja define genocide as a process rather than a singular event.
We tend to think of genocide as a process of group destruction, which may entail a kind of a dynamic of escalation over time. But in any case, it's violence that's directed at civilian groups as such, whether there's an explicit intention to destroy the group or whether it's part of the process as it unfolds over time.
And part of the reason why scholars use the term process, which may or may not include explicit intent, is because genocide's legal definition has its flaws. Let me explain. The legal definition insists that there is proof of genocidal intent before a party can be convicted of the crime. Makes sense, right? But Verdeja says that in many cases, finding proof of explicit intent is incredibly challenging. And that's why, historically, genocidal perpetrators rarely state their intentions explicitly from the start.
Genocides often occur as part of a process. That is, they're rarely, if ever, the first choice or first option that is selected by leaders. Rather, leaders seek to obtain a particular answer, a particular type of result in conflict, and they find that the methods that they're using are unsatisfactory for whatever set of reasons, whatever their extremist set of goals are.
So genocidal perpetrators slowly ramp up their response to the group they consider a problem. Genocide is seen as the solution to an ongoing issue, not a response at the beginning of a conflict. So this made me think, okay, what types of events, behaviors, and mindsets seem to lead to genocide? I'm not saying that these things can be predicted with 100% accuracy, but genocide doesn't spring up out of nowhere. According to various sources, there are some ways to identify risk factors. One notable genocide scholar, Gregory Stanton, noted 10 stages of genocide in his work during the late 90s and early 2000s. He notes things such as classification, dehumanization, and discrimination in society as risk factors. Other scholars note that a history of specifically state-led discrimination and violence against a particular group is crucial to understanding the build-up to a genocide. Now, we all know that discrimination is not a new phenomenon, right? And likewise, the issues between Palestine and Israel aren't new. Look, the specifics of this would warrant a longer conversation. But simply put, Israel and Palestine have engaged in decades of tense, often violent conflict, ranging from land rights and occupation to social inequality.
We're hearing live fire,
rising death toll.
Settler violence is a part of daily life under occupation. And so is the brutality of the Israeli army who enforces it.
She is one of about 2,600 hardline religious Jews who buy up homes from Palestinian families in Palestinian neighborhoods, often clandestinely and with huge sums of money from international donors.
These are Israeli settlers attacking Palestinian homes.
For example, the Nakba, which translates to the catastrophe, describes the forced displacement of between 500 to 700,000 Palestinians, if not more, in the early 20th century. Now, I know some of you listeners may be thinking conflict is not the right word to use because of disproportionality of the power dynamic that exists between Israel and Palestine. And I agree, but I wanted to explain the idea for simplicity reasons, and hence I used the word conflict.
One of the biggest myths about the Israel-Palestine conflict is that it's been going on for centuries.
Israel, it's the only Jewish nation in the world, and it didn't officially exist until 1948.
In order for us to understand the context, I want to talk a little bit about the history here. The British specifically were very instrumental in this displacement. By 1947, the UN officially mandated a partition splitting the land into Israel and Palestine. Now, this marked the creation of an oasis for Jewish populations who migrated to the land in the 20th century, escaping persecution. But we cannot forget the targeted violence that Palestinians faced as a result.
On November 2, 1917, Britain's Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, wrote a letter that would set off a conflict still being fought more than 100 years later. When Balfour wrote of his government's intent to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine, 90% of the people living there were not Jewish. Just 31 years later, most of them were gone.
The newly formed Israel had the support of powerful Western nations and their militaries, who then forced Palestinians from their homes. This basically laid the groundwork for the tension that we still see escalating today. Now, I do want to point out here that Israel has a very strong military and they still receive a lot of support from Western nations, especially the US, and hence the word conflict is a complicated term to use for this particular dynamic. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they are also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feed Into Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feed Into Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts.
The U.S. has officially moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And in doing so, President Trump has reversed decades of consensus about the city's status.
Another characteristic of genocide is the haphazard and dehumanizing treatment of civilians. Since October 7th, the Palestinian death toll is almost 40,000 people. According to many sources, these are largely civilians and children at that. Take a listen to Professor Verdeja's take on this.
In the war in Gaza in particular, we've seen the use of sieges and the denial of food and medicine, which essentially punishes the entire Gazan civilian population. We have, as of right now, plenty of reports that talk about starvation or near starvation in many parts of Gaza, with the possibility of a massive outbreak of famine. These are all targeted attacks, essentially, that draw no distinction between civilians and armed opponents.
And various Israeli leaders have used dehumanizing language when referring to Palestinians, as I highlighted in our other episode called The Quiet Violence of Language.
You know, I'm very puzzled by the constant concern which the world and also Britain, I must say, Mark, is showing for the Palestinian people and is actually showing for these horrible, inhuman animals who have done the worst atrocities that this century has seen and the worst atrocities that Jews have suffered since the Holocaust.
When we put this together, along with the use of very heavy weaponry that causes enormous damage, the use of different types of chemical weapons, such as phosphorus weapons. We see, for instance, the use of massive bombs that essentially obliterate entire buildings. There really reflects no commitment to distinguish between civilian and non-civilian groups.
And yet, you'll repeatedly hear Israel insisting that they don't have genocidal motives. They'll often use national security and defense as the reason for civilian death instead. The argument here is that Israel is targeting Hamas and the civilians killed are perhaps nothing but unfortunate casualties. I kid you not, if I had a penny every time I heard this argument, I would be pretty rich by now. Not just that, Palestinian civilians are sometimes accused of harboring Hamas members. There's this clip of Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, arguing with a journalist over this exact issue. Take a listen.
With all due respect, if you have a missile in your goddamn kitchen and you want to shoot it at me, am I allowed to defend myself?
But the question is this. Ultimately, you can't remove the people of Gaza. They're going to be stuck in this neighborhood.
So we have to fight. What do you want us to do? So we tell them, get out, and we fight against the launchers.
We hear Herzog comparing Hamas to a missile in the living room symbolizing Palestine's civilian areas. He also claims to be trying to protect Palestinians by warning them of attacks in advance. And again, there's another conversation between Israeli historian Benny Morris and political scientist Norman Finkelstein discussing the same issue.
Family, you know, if Israel wanted to kill civilians in Gaza, they could have killed 500,000 by now with the number of strikes they've done.
And therefore,
the fact that they've only killed a certain small number.
30,000 is a small number.
Small number in proportion.
You consider 30,000 a small number.
Small number in proportion over 4 months probably is an indication. And if the Hamas is hiding behind civilians die.
Every time they target, a kid, I'm sure they believe it's Hamas.
You know what? To me, it sounds like the mass civilian casualties are a price the Israeli government is willing to pay if it means counteracting Hamas. But here's what Professor Ernesto Verdeja had to say about that argument.
It's an interesting argument. It's not an uncommon argument, but I think from a legal perspective, and even just from kind of a more obvious logical perspective, it actually is deeply problematic. It's not particularly convincing.
So why is this defense insufficient? Aside from the massive civilian death toll for Verdeja, this boils down to the difference between the words intent, which is included in the legal definition of genocide, and the word motive. Intent is what you want or plan to do. Motive is the reason or justification for what you want or plan to do. And motivations can be different for the same intention. For example, if I intend to go to the gym, my motivation might be to have more energy, lose some weight, or build a certain type of body. So when we talk about Israel, national security is a motivation. But that does not disprove intent, because the two, according to Professor Verdeja, are separate.
So to the extent that a perpetrator says that what they're doing is largely out of self-defense or out of security, that doesn't necessarily mean that genocide is not occurring. In fact, the argument in favor of security is a long, long argument brought about by genocidal regimes.
Verdeja goes on to pull an example from the Guatemalan Civil War.
An obvious example, for instance, is the civil war in Guatemala, particularly the period during the early 1980s, when the Guatemalan government was carrying out mass destruction of indigenous populations, largely wiping out entire villages at an enormous scale. And they did this as part of their counterinsurgency war against rebels. And they did it out of an argument that this was the only way to ensure security. But nevertheless, it was genocidal, because it included the intent to destroy the indigenous population in whole or in part.
Now, the Guatemalan Civil War from 1960 to 1996 saw the murder or disappearance of around 150,000 to 200,000 civilians. That's a huge number. Government military units destroyed villages, burnt homes, ruined the water supply, and tortured their victims. Death squads killed thousands of civilians, the peak of these murders between 1980 and 1983, as some sources quote. The primary targets of this genocide were indigenous Mayan civilians, who the government suspected of supporting insurgents. Look, I can't make too many other comparisons between Palestine and Guatemala. Comparisons sometimes oversimplify what's happening, and while some parts of these situations may be similar, others may be very different. But here's what I'm trying to say. At the very least, Guatemala shows us just how taxing supposed national security can be. This idea that targeted mass violence will be the solution to a state's security is terrifying and flawed at best. And as Professor Verdeja shared with us, this mass mistreatment of civilians is part of the genocidal process.
And essentially, they come to see the civilian population that they're engaged in fighting with as the enemy as such. It's not just about the armed actors whom they're opposing, but it's the entire civilian population. There's no distinction or really significant difference between the civilian and armed actors. It's at that point that we normally see really large-scale violence turning or morphing into something like genocide.
So now the question becomes whether or not we are seeing a similar situation with Israel. Now we know that international bodies are definitely trying to investigate that question. In December of 2023, South Africa filed an application to the International Court of Justice, or the ICJ, which is the judicial component of the UN. South Africa's application was an 84-page long statement that Israel was committing genocide against Palestinians. And in the introduction, the application reads that while they condemn Hamas's attacks on Israeli civilians, They say no armed attack, regardless of how serious, can justify a breach of the 1948 Genocide Convention. What follows is an outline of all the specific reasons why South Africa is speaking against Israel's actions. In the end, South Africa argues in favor of an immediate ceasefire. On Thursday, January 11th of this year, the International Court of Justice met for an opening hearing of South Africa's case. Take a listen.
For the past 96 days, Israel has subjected Gaza to what has been described as one of the heaviest conventional bombing campaigns in the history of modern warfare. Palestinians in Gaza are being killed by Israeli weaponry and bombs from air, land, and sea. They are also at immediate risk of death by starvation, dehydration, and disease as a result of the ongoing siege by Israel, the destruction of Palestinian towns, the insufficient aid being allowed through to the Palestinian population, and the impossibility of distributing this limited aid while bombs fall. This conduct renders essentials to life unobtainable.
As we know, many countries have supported South Africa's case, but the US is not one of them. President Joe Biden and other US officials disagree with South Africa's statements. The US has also vetoed various resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire. Although more recently we've noticed that Biden administration seems to disagree at least slightly with Israel's level of bombing.
This war has taken a greater toll on innocent civilians than all previous wars in Gaza combined. More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of whom are not Hamas. Thousands and thousands of innocents, women and children, girls.
Now look, just to clarify, this is still a preliminary hearing. And while the ICJ agrees that Israel is responsible for the massive Palestinian death toll and that this must come to an end, the court has not called for an immediate ceasefire as South Africa requested. According to Professor Weteha, who wrote about this case back in February, the ICJ is using the definition of genocide from the 1948 Genocide Convention. As I discussed, the definition isn't waterproof, and the ICJ is perhaps limited by those strict legal confines. In his article, Professor Vidya suggests yet another way that legal terms can backfire. Often, the law gives states too much room to legally justify their mass violence. Legal justifications ignore the original purpose of the Genocide Convention, which is to protect civilians. Now, one way that we might bypass the legal restraints of genocide is by using a different terminology, according to Professor Vidya. Take a listen.
So, in addition to genocide, we have war crimes, which include the violations of the law of armed conflict. This can include, among other things, indiscriminate targeting of civilians, attacks on protected spaces like schools and hospitals, mistreatment of civilians and prisoners of war, the denial of food, the denial of medicine, and other types of actions that are not mitigated by military necessity. So the idea here being essentially that attacking the bases of civilian existence, collective life, attacking those in the context of armed combat can actually qualify as a major crime in international law.
And then there's also crimes against humanity.
Crimes against humanity can include a range of things such as murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation or forcible transfer of populations, imprisonment, torture, sexual violence, things like this. Those types of actions qualify as crimes against humanity when they're part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against a civilian population.
I know. this may at first seem like minimization somehow, right? The word genocide catches our ears for a reason. If we forego it, do we risk minimizing and delegitimizing a very serious situation? Look, I'm sure a lot of you are thinking that. I thought that too. But we cannot deny that there are benefits to using these other terms. Their definitions still center around civilian populations and what must be done to protect them. And in the definitions of war crimes or crimes against humanity, there is no focus on proving a group's intent. And that can make such atrocities easier to prosecute.
In that respect, unsurprisingly, in international crimes or international criminal tribunals, there's often more of a focus on prosecuting people for war crimes and crimes against humanity because the bar of proof is a little bit lower. It's a little bit easier to achieve.
And while we can deliberate on the efficacy of using other terms, Professor Wadia himself is not shying away from the question of genocide. In fact, he shared his stance with us.
Even though it would be very hard to show and identify a plan of genocidal violence, kind of a pre-existing plan, and by the way, those things rarely, if ever, exist, what you can infer is a process of escalating violence that effectively reflects a targeting and a destruction of the civilian population in whole or in part. And the South African case in the International Court of Justice has mobilized a lot of information on this. It's brought about a lot of evidence and indications that even major political and military leaders in Israel have used what is effectively genocidal type language, talking about Gazans as animals, as enemies, as people with whom you can't negotiate, etc. This in conjunction with the actions that the Israeli armed forces have carried out, all point to me at least as a pretty plausible argument for genocide being committed by the Israeli Defense Forces and by the Israeli state.
Now, despite all the information that I've shared here, and despite what Professor Verdeja thinks based on his expert opinion, unfortunately, the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, may take years before they reach a decision. And using the high-stakes term genocide may only complicate the case. So I am torn between whether or not we should use the term genocide, despite the fact that there is enough evidence to show that this, in fact, is a genocidal process.
So we shouldn't expect this to move very quickly. It's going to move very, very slowly. And what this essentially means is that, as important as the courts may be, the courts are not the primary venue here for ending the conflict. The courts are also not the primary venue, in my estimation at least, for bringing about anything like full accountability or full responsibility. They're far too narrow in their focus, and they don't address all of the deep questions and the deep aspects of violence that are occurring here. That is, not only direct violence, that is killing and maiming and torture that comes from this conflict, but also the deep forms of structural violence, the destruction of the entire structures of Gazan society, nor do they focus on all the other types of violence, such as cultural and symbolic violence.
So as we wrap up this episode, I want to ask you, where does this conversation leave us in the ongoing discrepancy over whether genocide is occurring right now? The media tends to frame this argument in a black and white way. One side says Israel is not genocidal at all, and the other side says it is. But Wadia argues that for most academics and humanitarian activists, the opinions are not as varied.
What you find is the question largely pivots around whether what Israel is committing is genocide already or it's on the brink of genocide. That is around this question of intentionality. Is it clear that Israel is intentionally carrying out the destruction of the Gazan population in whole or in part, or is it on the brink of doing so?
You know, as I was listening to Professor Verdeja's comments and preparing for this episode, I realized that whether or not we agree with the term genocide, which some of you may not, the fact that genocide is a part of the conversation we should be paying attention to what's happening. If we are debating whether or not a state's actions qualify as genocide, then there is already something incredibly wrong here, right? Because that means the death and destruction have already reached a crucial point, and we should be working to stop it. Our humanity begs us to do just that. And by the way, this by no means is a political stance. It is a stance against inhumanity and for shared humanity. Now, we did ask Professor Verdeja if he believed the legal definition of genocide is even useful nowadays, given that so many scholars have a problem with it. And this question was more about the future, because at the end of the day, what's happening right now has to be prevented so things like this do not happen in the future. On the one hand, Professor Verdeja explains, obviously, this is the definition we currently have. So this is the definition we currently have to work with. The odds of it changing soon are pretty low. But he also said something in this answer, which honestly was a little shocking to me. Take a listen.
So it's a product of its time in many respects. And this means that it was heavily influenced by the politics of the time. The Soviet Union, for instance, wanted to ensure that the persecution of groups because of their political or economic status would not qualify as genocide, because that's what they were doing. The United States was concerned about the use of a new genocide law that could be used to hold the United States accountable for its treatment of African Americans and, of course, indigenous peoples as well. So there's a lot of politicized discourse and politicized movements around the development of the law at the time.
Pretty bad, right? I mean, think about it. So much of our definition hinges on the political motivations of world powers decades ago, who were heavily discriminatory to members of their nations as well. Maybe that's important to consider as we think about the legal territory of our words. As always, I like to end episodes on some type of hopeful note, or at least an educational point that may lead all of you to more resources. My hope comes in form of a difficult question. What does the end of this mass murder look like? Or can we even imagine the end right now? It can be hard to see a future in the midst of the present moment. Healing and reconciliation take a lot of time and effort when it comes to mass atrocities, genocide included, of course. Here's what Professor Verdeja had to say.
One thing that's worth considering is however long the violence has gone on, however deep the roots are historically, is a good thumbnail sketch or a good understanding of how long it'll take to bring about something like a just peace and deep reconciliation. These things don't occur overnight. If you have a history of significant harm and violations and marginalization that have been going on for a long time, you're unlikely to bring about reconciliation very, very quickly. It just isn't likely.
Again, reconciliation isn't easy. But the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we can push our energies towards addressing the structural issues that lead to mass atrocities in the first place. So again, our sources are linked in the show notes if you want to know more, especially since we couldn't cover everything in great detail. Ernesto Verdeja has written and spoken about genocides in general at length, so be sure to look into his work in particular if his line of thinking resonated with you. It's also important to read up on and listen to the voices engaged with this conflict every single day. Many Palestinian journalists and filmmakers have spoken up on these issues, most of them working on the front lines, such as Motaz Azeza, Bisan Oda, and how can we not mention Shirin Abu Akhla, a Palestinian-American journalist who died in 2022. We recently highlighted Akhla on Immigrantly Instagram for Women's History Month as someone who dedicated 25 years to reporting on Israel and Palestine. If you have any other sources and notable people you would like to share with us, feel free to contact me. You can always reach out at sadia@immigrantlypod.com. I hope this episode, at least parts of it, resonated with you. You learned something new. As a rights activist who has studied genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, I really, really hope we can move past political affiliations and tribalism to see what's really happening so that humanity does not suffer again in any part of the world. This episode was produced by me, written by Michaela Strother. Editorial review was done by Shay Yu. Our editor and sound designer for this episode is Paroma Chakravarti. Special thanks to Professor Ernesto Verteja for his valuable comments. I really hope you took something important, valuable, a learning, an insight, which will help you look at things a little differently. Come back next week when I sit down with Vinita Srivastava for an important conversation. Take care and be kind to yourselves.